Dochinum, Jorge Collar, tape number 3. Jonathan Rosenblum speaking on Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, Portrait of a Refined Religious Personality.
A different goal. He's going to present the model Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, Gadol Batorah, Gaon in learning, and princely in midos. The Altar of Slobodka used to say, the word I see can mean many different things. On a superficial level, I could say, I see this crowd. But sometimes I see can go beyond the pure reality of I see. Sometimes when you see a portrait of somebody, you could say, I see that person. Sometimes when you do a study on a person and you don't even see a portrait, you can say, I see this person. And sometimes you can hear a concept, the altar says, and say, I see. And that I see doesn't really mean, of course, I see, it means I hear. And it actually doesn't mean that either. It means I understand. Rabbi Yonason, interestingly enough, never met Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zichrono Livracha. But I could say that Rabbi Yonason can say on Rabbi Yaakov, I saw him, I knew him, I was extremely close with him. He simply reconstructed the great godless of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. And how important it is for us to have a real role model. Not just to hear, of course it's very important to hear what a Baal Musar should look like, what a Baal Midah should be, but it's even more important to actually see that, because once you see it, it's real. Once you see it, you think, you know that it can exist in reality. It's not just a nice story. Well, Rabbi Yonason is par excellence in his authorship of many Gedolei Torah. The most recent one, the Michta Melio, Rav Dessler, and giving us a view, and maybe even it's a better view in a certain sense, a more realistic view than maybe some of the grandchildren sitting here, because klum adam meir al beno is klum adam meir al savishalo. Sometimes it's more important to see an objective reality. In case the people are wondering, how come didn't ask Rabbi Shlomo to speak about his grandfather? The answer to that is he speaks about him all the time. They're tired of him. Right? But afterwards, after Rabbi Yonason presents what I think will be a very thorough, deep, and inspiring talk on Rabbi Yaakov, Rabbi David Kamenetsky and Rabbi Yosef Kamenetsky will give some of their experiences they actually experienced with Rabbi Yaakov, though, as I said before, I'm not sure at this point what is more real anymore. Without any further ado, Rabbi Yonason.
To tell you the truth, I had the same question as many of you. If at Darche Noam, Chappelle's girls' school, it seems that half the staff is made up of grandchildren of Rabbi Yaakov, why in the world was I invited here today to speak on Rabbi Yaakov? I only hope when I'm done you won't have the same question, only stronger. In any event, there's one point, one central point that I want to emphasize about Rabbi Yaakov. And that is the absolute dominance of his intellect over every other aspect of his life. And in some sense, I would say this is typical of all those who are characterized, described as Balei Musar. Rabbi Yaakov, you should know, was not an adherent of any of the famous systems of Musar. Shortly after his marriage, spent 6 months in the Kelm Yeshiva, which is one of the great Musar yeshivas of Europe. In Kelm, everything was figured out down to the last degree. They had special waste baskets. If you threw something into the waste basket and you didn't put it in just perfectly, the whole waste basket tipped over to teach you to do everything carefully. In Kelm, if you turned your head to one side or another, you had to be able to give an explanation. Why did you turn your head? Why did you move your eyes? Rabbi Yaakov said it later about that experience. 6 months everyone should spend in Kelm, but no more. Because for him, normalcy was the key. He held that if the Torah was the blueprint for all of creation, and therefore the blueprint for man's creation, then observance of the Torah should never look strained. It shouldn't look like something forced. It should always appear to be something natural. As a matter of halacha, he said the brisker matzahs, the burned brisker matzahs, cannot be what the halacha requires. It's just not possible that something so untasteful, distasteful, should be what's required by the Torah. That sense of normalcy, of everything fitting together, in the end, what stands out about Rabbi Yaakov's personality is the way, by shaping himself in light of the Torah, by looking deeply into the words of the Torah, by reflecting upon them, by a lifetime of work, the perfection of a human being that could be shaped. It's important to understand, even though I'm not going to discuss this and I don't think it's capable of being discussed, to quantify or even to put in qualified terms Rabbi Yaakov's greatness in Torah. But without knowing that in advance, it's impossible to understand who he was or where that greatness came from. Many often didn't understand that almost everything he did had its source in the Torah. One time a grandson-in-law called him up after a car accident, and he told him that he had been in an accident and delayed. He was going to meet Rabbi Yaakov at the time, and Rabbi Yaakov's first question was, did you hurt anybody? Not, were you hurt? Did you hurt anybody? Because the Gemara says a person should be more fearful that he should cause damage to anybody else than that he should cause damage to himself. That was an instinctive, natural reaction. But no, these sayings and many of the beautiful mitos which I will describe today, they are not natural. They are not born. People are not born that way. People make themselves, they create themselves in such a fashion. As Rabbi Yaakov Greenwald, a close Talmud and a leading psychologist in Muncie, once said to me, being with Rabbi Yaakov was like riding in a Rolls Royce. You never felt you were moving. You never had any sense of the brilliance in everything he said. It was so natural. It was so integrated. It was so normal. A young bacher who was a house bacher for Rabbi Yaakov for a period of 2 weeks, was once asked, what did you see by Rabbi Yaakov? He said, I saw absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. Only later, when he began to delve into certain halakhas, did he realize how calculated everything that had taken place in the house was, how calculated al pi halakha everything that was going on was. But at the time, it was fully integrated, fully normal. Rabbi Yaakov Greenwald tells a story which I think illustrates this. Very late in his life, Rabbi Yaakov was already in his late 80s, his Rebbetzin, second wife, was about to undergo open-heart surgery. She had undergone open-heart surgery, and prior to that surgery, Yaakov Greenwald was coming to Israel, and Rabbi Yaakov had asked him to get brachas for his wife from the Stifler, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, and other Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael. Having accomplished that mission, Rabbi Greenwald called back the night after the operation. What he forgot, he was used to calling from America to Israel, which is a later time zone, so he called in the late morning, which was in fact 2 o'clock in the morning, in Muncie. He made a miscalculation. He forgot that the time was behind in America. 2 o'clock in the morning, the night following open heart surgery for a woman in her 80s, You know that a phone call doesn't mean your wife is resting comfortably. We just thought we'd call you in the middle of the night to tell you that. A person cannot help but be terrified at that point. A groggy Rav Yaakov picked up the phone, and Rav Greenwald immediately realized what had taken place. And he was horrified at his mistake, how much he must have scared Rav Yaakov. But Rav Yaakov talked to him, never mentioned that it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and began to talk to him so that he wouldn't feel bad about this mistake. Began to talk to him as if it was just the middle of the day. He started to say, oh yes, the Rebbetzin is resting well. She already gave me instructions about the cholent, and don't forget the beans for the cholent on Shabbos. As if he were talking to somebody, just a casual conversation. As Rav Greenwald told me, unless you've been working your whole life, you don't have that control. That's not something a person comes to at that moment. That's something a person comes to from a lifetime of effort, striving, thinking about everything that they do. And that is what so characterized Rav Yaakov. In his mind, and I think in some sense, my own biography of Rav Yaakov misses a whole level to capture the dialectical quality of his mind. Rav Nissen Wolpin, who was the dorm counselor in Torah Vadas when Rav Yaakov was the Rosh Hashiva, told me, I remember many of the stories that are related in your book. And I remember him telling a particular bacher, a particular student, exactly what's recorded in your book. But what you don't know is what he told me after that particular student left the room. You don't know how many other levels there were of his thought process beyond that which was said and which is recorded for history. There were full other levels. Everything that Rav Yaakov did was done with total control. Even the exterior that he presented to the world, and he's famous for a smile, the warmth of his smile that he always presented. Famous mostly, above all, I would say, for the quality of the advice that he gave to people. And yet he told one of his grandsons once, the reason that I'm able to give such advice is because I always maintain a certain level of emotional distance. The person wants somebody who can retain an objective perspective on what's going on. I let their pain enter me, but only so far. Because if it were more than that, I would not be able to give the piece of advice that they're looking for. Now, I want you to know that this is not typical of every gadol. There is no such thing as a generic gadol. Rav Yaakov was a particular individual, unique individual person, and I could contrast for you other gadolim who were completely different in some ways. Take Rav Yehuda Segel, the great Manchester Rosh Hashiva, the person who most pushed the agenda of learning Lashon Hora in our days. Towards the end of his life, one of his grandchildren said to him, you know, I just read someplace about a new way of putting on a talis, and Rav Segel became very excited by that, and he said, wow, if I can add another hither in putting on a talis, I'm going to do that too. To Rav Yaakov, that would have been almost laughable. To him, when you first put on a talis, you have to figure out everything about putting on a talis. You don't change. To Rav Segel, his power to give people's advice was his complete identification with them. Rav Yaakov was a different person. The mitos that he presented to the world were as refined as anybody could ever remember, but they were refined through the medium of his incredible intellect, of his reflection upon the words of the Torah. Now, I'd like to talk about some of those specific mitos and how they came out. Rav Zelig Epstein, perhaps the gadol in America closest to Rav Yaakov, described once that there are many beautiful things which, taken as a whole, in their entirety, are beautiful, but if thrown down and broken, the parts would not make up anything beautiful. With Rav Yaakov, it was different. It was like a golden crown with precious jewels in a diadem. If they would throw it, thrown down, that crown would shatter. Each individual quality there, each individual aspect, would itself shine through. So what I'm going to do now is break down some of those mitos just as a way of being illustrative of what it means and what a person can get to and what we could strive to. And I'm emphasizing this point about the work that was involved in becoming Rav Yaakov. Rabbi Yaakov was not born as a finished person. He made himself who he was. And that's why reading his biography or reading, and I think it's true reading any Gadol's biography, is not just an occasion for throwing up your hands and saying, I can't be like that. How could I ever get there? He was born with talents which were not available to me. Because you have to understand that the principal talent was the ability and the willingness to work on oneself and to think deeply about everything that one was doing. First, there was an incredible simplicity. Not holding anything of himself that Rav Yosef Elias once told me. He said there are gedolim who feel it's important to act with the derech of malchus, of kingship, and that their talmidim should reflect that and honor them as a king because the covet of the Torah should be so great. There are others who adopt the mode of pashtus, of simplicity, and think nothing of reacting to everybody precisely at his level. I think any of you know, and I think this is passed down, of all the Kamenetskys, I know this is something that's passed down through the generations, this absolute simplicity. Rav Yaakov, when he was the Rosh Hashiva of Torah Vadas, thought nothing if he saw little kids playing ball in the street and the ball rolled under a car, of getting down on the ground and crawling under the car to fetch their ball for them. In his later years, living in Muncie, when his wife would go out shopping, somebody would always come and drive her and take her out shopping. He would sit by the door when he expected her to come home, listening for the car door, for the car to pull in the driveway so he could be out there as quickly as possible to bring in the groceries. Not nothing about, in his 80s, of still being the one to bring in the groceries and that it was beneath the dignity of the unquestioned manhig, leader of the generation in America. One time a certain woman came to visit his wife, and she wasn't home. So Rabbi Yaakov sat with her and her daughter for a prolonged period of time talking to her. And then finally the Rebbetzin came home, and they were talking, and then the woman started talking to the Rebbetzin. But every time Rabbi Yaakov tried to leave the kitchen where they were having a conversation, every time the woman started to talk again, even though her remarks were not addressed to Rabbi Yaakov, he stopped and turned around rather than leave the room, because he felt it was rude. It was inconsiderate. It showed a lack of respect for somebody to leave the room when they were talking, even if their remarks weren't addressed to them. It took the woman a long time before she realized what was happening, so Rabbi Yaakov could finally go back to his learning. But that was the simplicity with which he did everything. He was incredibly sensitive in the finest details, of what the effect of his actions would be on somebody else. For instance, he made it a klal, a principle, that whoever asked him to officiate at a particular simcha, whether to be go to a vort or whatever, whoever asked him first, he always accepted, and that's where he went first. Why? And this happened in many cases where somebody he barely knew, he had only spoken to over the phone once or twice, called him up and asked him to be present at a vort, an engagement ceremony of one of his children, and then somebody who was a close talmid called later, and he went to the first. So he should never be put in the position of saying to one person that somebody else took precedence over you, even if there was a perfectly good explanation which would have been accepted by anyone. He didn't allow anybody to answer the phone for him and say, the Rosh Hashiva is busy now, can you call back later? If he had to tell somebody to call back later because he was involved in a discussion at that time, he himself got on the phone to tell that person, you know what, I can't talk now, I'm in a meeting, but would you please call back later? I'm very eager to talk to you. He always made those people think that it was, in fact, an honor for him to talk to them. When he talked to somebody, when somebody came to him for advice, and this shows you the way to work out something in every particular detail, down to the last detail. If he would learn at his dining room table with all the books placed on one side of the dining room table, when he came to speak to somebody, he would move down to the other side of the dining room table because he felt if his sforim were present in front of him, the person would feel constrained during the whole conversation because they would have a constant reminder in front of them, you know, I'm keeping Rav Yaakov from learning. I'm keeping one of the Gedolei Ador from learning Torah. So everything that I'm doing right now is at his expense. So he was always careful to move down to the other end of the table so a person should never have to think that. the degree, somebody was once going on a trip with him early in the morning. And when he met Rabbi Yaakov at the train station, he realized that he hadn't slept the entire night before. He had known he had to get up very early in the morning, and he had gone to bed thinking that he was going to set an alarm clock to wake himself up in the morning. But then he realized that he had a neighbor, non-Jewish neighbor, who worked a night shift. And the time that that alarm clock would be going off in order to awaken him for his early morning appointment to get to the train station was precisely the same. Shortly after that, his Gentile neighbor would have gone to sleep. And he was afraid that the sound of his alarm clock might disturb the sleep of his neighbor. Rather than set an alarm clock that would disturb his neighbor's sleep, he stayed up the entire night spent a sleepless night so that he shouldn't disturb somebody else. When we talk about the intelligence of our Gedolim, I think we miss the point. It's not just the intelligence. It's the degree to which that intelligence is devoted to a particular purpose, to the degree to which that intelligence is used to sensitize themselves and to use it to benefit and to help others. That as much as Rabbi Yaakov spent his time thinking about the Torah, he spent his time also learning up the Parsha of what it means, the emotions of human beings, and the sensitivity to the emotions of a human being, and how he could be responsive to those. One time, his youngest son, Avram, used to come and learn with him once a week in Muncie. And sometimes people would come to visit Rav Yaakov during the time that his son was there. He would spend a full day there, and Rav Yaakov would ask him to stay out of the room. Would he excuse himself for a moment while he spoke to whoever had come to visit. One time, Rav Yaakov asked his son to remain in the room. A father and a daughter came to visit them, and Rav Yaakov asked Rav Avram to stay in the room, which was already something curious. It's something that he never did. So Rav Avram's curiosity was raised. Then at the beginning of the discussion, Rav Yaakov introduced everybody in the room, and then he put his arm around his son, who was already a man in his late 40s, and he said, "And this is my Bebele Avram. This is my little baby Avram." And after a few more moments of small talk, he said to his son that he could go out now, and he would talk to the father and daughter alone. Needless to say, his son's curiosity was highly aroused now. What had happened, and why had his father suddenly at 48 decided to call him my little Bebele? What had happened was this. This was the father's youngest child, somebody to whom he was incredibly close. But as fathers are wont to do, we often forget the sensitivities of a teenager. She was a young teenager, and her father had made the terrible mistake of introducing her to somebody as my baby. And at that point, this daughter, who had had a very close relationship her whole life with her father, stopped talking to her father. This went on for weeks that she refused to talk to her father, and her father was completely broken by this. Finally, he called Rabbi Yaakov and asked Rabbi Yaakov to help him. Would he speak to his daughter? Everything that Rabbi Yaakov had done was then a hatzagah, a production, so that this 13-year-old girl should hear Rabbi Yaakov refer to his middle-aged son as my Bebele, and she would know that what her father had done was not such a tragedy, was not such an insult. It certainly, if Rabbi Yaakov called his son this, it wasn't meant to insult her or to infantilize her. It was meant as a term of affection. And the father had, in fact, called Rabbi Yaakov back the next week and said he put everything to right with that conversation. Everything else was just was icing on the cake. But with that use of his intelligence, that ability to think about what would be perfectly needed in this situation. The night before his wife went in for that surgery, which I described before, somebody came into the house. And how did they find Rabbi Yaakov? They find Rabbi Yaakov going through the Muncie phone book. Now, the Muncie phone book wouldn't seem to be the natural place to be the night before your wife is undergoing open-heart surgery. He wasn't reciting Tehillim, he was going through the Muncie phone book. And they asked him, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm writing down the names of all the people who are close to the Rebbetzin. Because I know that tomorrow, after the operation, they're going to be anxious all day to know what happened. How did the operation go? I don't want to keep them waiting a moment longer than necessary, and I'm looking up every one of their numbers now so I'll be able to personally call them as soon as we know the results and as soon as there's something positive to tell them, I'll be able to tell them immediately. The sensitivity to the seconds of somebody else, it was after all his wife. These were friends of the Rebbetzin, but it was his wife, and he was thinking about the concern that others would feel the next day. One time he was invited to a hotel for a Shabbos. And the subject at the and the Bar Mitzvah boy really laned very poorly. In the middle of the laning, Rabbi Yaakov had to go out of the laning for a few moments. And he missed part of the laning. Afterwards they asked him, would you like us to lane again? And Rabbi Yaakov said, no, he wouldn't like to hear the laning. Later he explained what his reasoning was. Since the Bar Mitzvah boy had lain poorly, he was afraid that if they laned again for Rav Yaakov, even though the reason was that he had missed part of the laning, the Bar Mitzvah boy would think to himself, they had to lane again because he didn't feel he could be Yotzi with my laning, and he would feel more embarrassed by the poor job he had done. Rather than hurt his feelings, he was prepared to forego listening to part of the laning on that Shabbos. The sensitivity to each individual where he was meant that everybody's psak, everybody's eitzah, was a personalized eitzah to the specific circumstances of the person involved at that level. A doctor once came to Rabbi Yaakov and asked him, he lived in Muncie, but he wanted to buy a Jaguar. Now he knew that in Muncie, driving around in a Jaguar would not be something that would give him great cover. And he was embarrassed, but he wanted a Jaguar. And he came and he asked Rabbi Yaakov, could he buy a Jaguar? Rabbi Yaakov had one question for him. In the doctor's parking lot in the hospital where you work, will a Jaguar be considered out of the ordinary? The man told him, no, it won't be the only one. And Rabbi Yaakov told him, in that case, you can buy a Jaguar. And just so the person didn't go away thinking to himself, but now he knows what a low person I am. What kind of real person who has any understanding of the values of the Torah wants a Jaguar, wants to waste his money on an expensive sports car? So that this person wouldn't go away with that bad feeling and embarrassed that he had asked such a silly question to Rabbi Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov's last words to him were, and when you buy it, I want the first ride. Rabbi Yaakov held that it was the optimum, the ideal situation was for a father, for a mother, to be at home with her children. And he once told a young Avreich that this was his shita, this is what he believed. But one time a wife came to Rabbi Yaakov, and the husband and wife came together, and she said she felt she had to work. So Rabbi Yaakov told her, yes, you should go out to work. So the husband later said to Rabbi Yaakov, but he said, you hold the ideal situation is that a mother should stay home. He said, yes, that's what I hold as the ideal situation. But when a person comes to ask me a question, I paskin according to the kochos, the talents and abilities and where they're holding at that moment. For your wife now, the best eitzah is that she should go out to work. For your wife, according to the resources that she has available to her, she should be working and not staying home and feeling miserable. He never put down a single psak halacha because each one in his mind had to be so carefully individualized. Once two people asked him within a short order of time, could they make a bris during the year of their avelis outside of the house? The halacha psuka is that you can't do such a thing during the avelis. Rabbi Yaakov told one person yes, and he told the other person no. The person he was told no had already heard about the person who had been told yes, and he asked Rabbi Yaakov what was going on. Rabbi Yaakov told him, you're a humble melamed. There's no reason for you to make a bris outside of your house. He is a well-to-do businessman. People won't realize why he's making a bris in the house if he makes a bris in the house. And they'll say, oh, he must be having financial difficulties. He must be on the verge of bankruptcy. It could hurt him with creditors. It could affect his entire business relationship with his creditors. Therefore, I told him to prevent such a situation from developing, he could make his normal bris outside of the house. That reason doesn't apply to you. But everything was so finely calibrated, so finely thought out. Rabbi Yaakov was the exemplar of Kiddush Hashem in the world, of the idea that he represented the Torah, that we, each one of us, represents the Torah wherever we go. He was acutely aware of this. Once in a doctor's office with a little boy, he basically couldn't speak English, or didn't speak too much English. He knew he had no way of communicating with this boy, a non-religious boy. So he took out a ball and started playing ball with him, because he said, I may be the only frum Jew he ever sees. I want him to remember, have a positive memory of an old Jew with a white beard. So he was careful to play ball with him. The nuns in Muncie, who lived near Rabbi Yaakov's house, asked after his patira, where is the nice old rabbi who always smiled at us? And the tragedy was that they added, he was the only one who always smiled at us. Everybody else looked the other way. Now Rabbi Yaakov may have been a gadol b'Torah, and Rabbi Yaakov may have been distinguished from most of his neighbors in Muncie in one way or another. But one way in which he was surely not distinguished was in his ability to smile, in his willingness to smile perhaps, but it takes only 7 muscles to smile. It takes over 200 to frown. Anyone in Muncie could have smiled at these nuns when they passed them, but Rabbi Yaakov did, and they didn't, because Rabbi Yaakov had learned the Gemaras, and he knew what it was to be Makdim Shalom, Afilu Lagoy Shebashuk, be the first to say hello to somebody else in the shuk. And that's what he did. When a Talmud of his wanted to set up a medical referral organization, which has become one of the top medical referral organizations in the country, he told them, you set it up both for Jews and non-Jews. It should not be just a Jewish referral organization. In some ways, when he dealt with issues of marriage, all these things came together. His sensitivity to the emotional construction of every human being, his learning of the parsha, what's a man, what's a woman, what are the differences between them, his own marriages, I say both, were to two completely different types of women from completely different backgrounds, were models of shalom bais, of marital bliss. And Rabbi Yaakov never tired of saying in public, in front of complete strangers, what he owed to each one of his wives, how they were so much responsible for everything that he was. One time a young husband came to Rabbi Yaakov and asked, there's a relative of my wife who's now becoming a moel, and my wife wants to know how many times does he have to do a milah before we should rely on him to do the milah. Does it have to be 2, or does it have to be 3? Do we pass him like Rebbe? How does she go? How much does he need to be have a chazaka? And Rabbi Yaakov said to him, get another moel. And he said, oh no, my wife is perfectly happy. She just wants to know what's the halakha. Rabbi Yaakov said to him, if she's asking the question, she's worried. No mother should be worried at her son's bris. Get another moel. I don't care what the halacha is, get another moel. Teaching you how to be sensitive to your wife. Rav Avram Greenfeld, who's one of the leading teachers of Chassanim in Muncie, once described the following situation at a wedding. Rav Yaakov got a message that his wife was eager, wanted to speak to him. He went to the mechitza to speak to her. She said, I want to know when the Rav wants to leave. And he said to her, I want to leave when you want to leave. And she said, for me, I want to leave when the Rav wants to leave. So he said, you know that it says in Mili to Alma that we follow the wife, and Mili to Shemaya, we follow the husband. So she said to him, well, my Mili to Alma is that I want to go when the Rav wants to go. And he says, my Mili to Shemaya is I want to go when you want to go. She said, okay, in a half an hour. And he went, as he often did when he finished and something was psuka, clapped his hands like that and said, in a half an hour. Can imagine what this meant, the impression this made, and the sensitivity to one another's feelings. What do you want? That was the first question he taught husbands. Use all your intelligence to learn up your wife's emotions, to be sensitive to every one of her emotions, and take those into account. That is your duty. He was willing himself to forego his own minhagim in his second marriage, lest he in any way embarrass or hurt his wife's feelings. In their first year of marriage, Shavuos came out on Friday. He had a minhag, which he didn't even know the source for, never to eat cheese on Friday. And you know, on Shavuos morning, We have a custom to make milchiks, and she had served many beautiful cheese dishes. When she first put these down on the table, he looked, he didn't know what to do. A lifetime of not eating cheese on Fridays. He had three town meeting with him. When the Rebbetzin went out of the room, he said, I want you to be matur neder for me, and I'm going to eat. And that's what he did. He was willing to go even further, even things which he felt were the better halachic practice. That was a minhag that he didn't know the source for, but where he even felt where it was a better halachic practice. When he got married, his second wife had the custom of making an early kiddush on mezonos and then eating the meal later. Rabbi Yaakov, his whole life, had always felt that you should make kiddush samach l'suda, and not until you were ready to sit down for the suda should you do so. But he was afraid that if he insisted on his minhag, it would appear, and he was a gadol, his second wife's first husband had been an ordinary, I don't say ordinary, had been a balabas, not been a Talmud Chacham, and he was afraid it would cast aspersions on her first husband and the way she had done things all her life. Rather than do that, he went along with the minhag that she had always observed, and he would start eating an earlier kiddush. The sensitivity to another person's feelings taking precedence even over what you consider to be the lechatchila performance of the mitzvah. The mitzvah, of course, for which Rabbi Yaakov is most known, is the mitzvah of emes. His own sefer is called Emes LeYaakov. It was something that defined his personality. He was appropriately named Yaakov. He said the test of Yaakov, when Yaakov had to dissemble or distort or deceive Yitzhak in any way, it was to him an unbelievable test to even utter a word of falsehood, to utter anything that came out of his mouth. I mean, his care in these matters, in any monetary matter, in any matter of truth, was so extraordinary. One time, a congregation gave him a silver cup as a token of their esteem, and his first thing that he did with it was to take it to a jeweler to have it appraised so he could report it on his income tax return. During the war, he came to visit. He was then a rav in Canada. He came to visit his children in America, and he told his son, meet me at the train station with a nickel for the subway fare because I'll be coming into America with no currency. Because then Canadian law forbid taking foreign currency out of Canada, so he couldn't even take a nickel across the border. When his son said, you know, the prime minister, when he leaves Canada, takes some money with him. Everybody takes some money. They don't mean a nickel. They mean $10,000. Rabbi Yaakov said, the prime minister of Canada has no ability to forgive the laws of Canada. I'm bound by the laws of Canada. He has no ability, and he came in without any money. Once he met his son, another son, at a train, and he saw that he had a library book from the Ner Yisrael library with him. And he said to his son, did you ask for permission to take that out? He said, I don't need permission. Everybody takes it. Did you ask for permission? No. How much would you say that book is worth? 75 cents. It's a long time ago. He said, you've been studying for years in yeshiva. You're soon to receive smicha, ordination. Because you took that book out of a library, you're a goslin, you're a thief. You could not be a rabbi, you could not be ordained, you could never sit, give witness or sit in judgment as a goslin. For 75 cents, you put in danger everything that you've been striving for years. As soon as we get home, whatever it takes to fix this up, to send the book back, to get them another book, you have to rectify this, the sensitivity to every pruta, to every action. These were not just words for him, that a person who took anything, no matter what value, was over an avera. This was the way he trained himself. He felt it was so terrible. And this is a lesson that if we learned in our yeshivas would be one of the most important legacies that Rabbi Yaakov could have to offer. To ever do anything half-heartedly, to ever do anything chap-chap, to do something that raised any questions. Said if you take an English course, if your yeshiva offers English, you study hard so you should never come later to think that you should never, because if you don't do everything to its maximum, if you don't study that material to its maximum, you'll come later to be lazy in Torah. He once said of a group of boys who used to learn Mishnah Berurah during their English classes at Torah Vadas, not one of them ever became a Gadol B'Torah. And he said, sharper. There was once he threw a boy out of a yeshiva for giving other boys answers on the New York Regents exams. And everybody else thought, what's the big deal? It's the Regents exams, it's secular exams, it's not important, and so forth. And Rabbi Yaakov said, and he was soon accepted in another yeshiva. 20 years later, that person was indicted on some kind of fraud. And Rabbi Yaakov said, I tried to save him. If they would have done like I did, if they would have, he wouldn't have been so quickly accepted. He would have learned cheating is cheating. Cheating on the regents exam, even to give somebody else an exam, is cheating. If you cheat in one place, you'll cheat in other places. And he would have been spared from that, and we would have been spared the Chilul Hashem that comes from not having this recognition. That was the sensitivity that he developed. One of the last point I'd like to make, which I think will be encouraging to all of us, though, to those who are already parents and all the rest who aspire to be, is it something of this, when what you have is not natural, but something that comes from work. Having this kind of example in front of you has an unbelievable impact. It becomes a legacy that can be transmitted from generation to generation. Of course, it always has to come in each generation. Those who succeed, the children and the grandchildren, they also have to follow in this. But having an example of what a perfection in Midos is makes it easier for them to have something to strive for. Reb David Kamenetsky, who was my chief advisor throughout the whole writing of the Reb Yaakov biography, the person who came, I mean, everybody at this table was an important advisor, but who was like my, like the finger you run over the chalaf, the knife for shechita, to test whether this could be true or not. He once told me about his own father, Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky, the Rosh Hashiva in Philadelphia. I never in my life saw my father angry. I never in my life saw my father raise his voice. And Reb Shmuel, except one time I saw my father angry, and he was shouting on the phone to somebody, and it was a complete shock to me. When he got off the phone, my father put the phone down, and then he told me as calmly as if he had never raised his voice at all, sometimes you have to shout at somebody. But even that was done with complete control. 2 years ago, I was speaking at a Torah Masorah convention. In the middle of the afternoon, on Shabbos afternoon, Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky, one of the most revered Rosh Hashivas in America, somebody to whom everybody in America comes for eitzes, decided not to stay in his room learning or sleeping or whatever else he could have been doing, but to come to Yonason Rosenblum, at the most a journalist, come and speak about pluralism issues in Israel, something that could probably not have been of the slightest interest to him. But because I had once spent a Shabbos in his house, because I had written a biography of his father, Reb Shmuel took an hour and a half of his time to come to hear lectures which were surely of no interest in him, which I never would have expected. I wouldn't have felt bad if he hadn't been there. But can you imagine what it means to a person when such an important Rosh Hashiva comes to hear you speak? I mean, the next day I happened to be speaking a little bit about Kiddush Hashem, and I had told Reb Shmuel that there would be many stories on his father, but here there was no reason whatsoever. And yet he did that. In my Shabbos, in Reb Shmuel's house in Philadelphia, I saw the way that one of the most integrated neighborhoods in Philadelphia, and I saw the way the neighbors looked to Reb Shmuel, that he was the person that they came to solve their Shalom Bais problems and stopped on Shabbos. The little girls in the neighborhood would stop him, and he'd ask them, how is your mother, how is your father, what's going on? The ease, just like the story of Reb Yaakov with the nuns, so was the story of Reb Shmuel with each one of his neighbors. One time, going through a dangerous neighborhood of Philadelphia, Reb Shmuel was being driven by somebody, and they saw somebody by the side of the road with a flat tire. Now, this is a neighborhood that people don't stop in. If you get in it, you try and get through as quickly as possible. Reb Shmuel told the driver to stop. Let's get out and see if we can help. Now again, just like Reb Yaakov's smile, Reb Shmuel knows a lot of things that his driver didn't know. He knows a lot of Torah that his driver didn't know. But he doesn't know how to drive. I'm sure he had never changed a tire in his life. But he understood if somebody's beside the road, it doesn't matter where the neighborhood is. And I don't really recommend this to everybody. I don't think I'd emulate it myself. But he was prepared to get out and figure out how to change a tire to help somebody change a tire. Because that's the kind of sensitivity to another human being that he had been raised with and seen. Just this last year, I got to know Rav Shalom Kamenetsky, Rav David's brother and Rav Shmuel's son. And I was at a chasana, And it was in Muncie, for a former student of mine, it was a pouring, bitter night. I got there so late, I thought that they must have finished three courses when I got there. And as I rushed in to change it, and I saw the father of the Kala, and I was apologizing profusely that I missed it. It had taken 3 hours to get from Manhattan. I said, "What do you mean missed it? We haven't even gotten to the Bedeckin yet. There's still..." And I was amazed. On such a night, Rav Shalom didn't even make it for that, but we were the 80 Yichud together, and as I was standing there with him, I asked him, this is a former student of mine, but I asked him, "What's your connection to Leah?" And he said to me, "Oh, she called me on the phone to ask me a Shaila a year and a half ago." And I said, "And after that, I've never talked to her again, but she asked me to come to her chasana." So he had driven from Philadelphia to Muncie, three and a half hours each way, to be at the chasana of somebody he didn't know. He also has things to do. He could have given many excuses. All those excuses would have been accepted. But the pashtus that has been handed down from generation to generation in the family, he just understood it was a normal thing. He didn't think any big deal about it, driving 7 hours by himself on a night when it was dangerous to drive, to come to be Misameach Akala, because he had heard she came from not such a religious family and she'd become more religious, and he wanted to be Mechazik her, and he wanted to be at her chasana. That was important enough to do this. The point is, we can all learn. I mean, the nice saying, I don't know why I was asked to speak, that's the truth, but I am very happy that I was, in at least one sense. It's been 8 years since I finished Reb Yaakov, and now I had a chance to go back and read the book last night. And it's worth it, because I said in the acknowledgments at the time, usually at the beginning of a book, an author says, "I must ask forgiveness for my wife for all the time that was spent away from the family in the production of this work." In this case, there's no forgiveness, there's no need for it, because my wife understands, my children understand. Baruch Hashem, you should write more books about people like Rav Yaakov. Baruch Hashem, Yirtzeh Hashem, you should keep reading Rav Yaakov over and over again every 6 months, to know what it means to be in the presence, to have an image of such a person, and to know that we won't be exactly like Rav Yaakov, but it doesn't depend on intellectual gifts. It depends on the will. We can do it. We can be taught by, but for something to us to be inspired to apply in our own lives.
I want to thank Rav Edison very much. I've heard it said, and I agree fully, that your book should not be placed amongst the biographies of Golem, rather it should be placed in the shelf of Musa Sfarim, as we truly now heard, a real Musa Shmuz, something that we can learn from and grow from. What my job is to give over some stories that are from my personal memories with my grandfather. What I feel very bad is that I actually did not spend much time with my grandfather. I came here to Israel before my bar mitzvah, and my grandfather lived in Muncie. The very few occasions that he did come here to Israel, so I tried to spend some time with him. On one of those occasions, it was when my sister, Rebbetzin Tribitz, if anybody knows my brother-in-law, Reb Meir Tribitz from Machon Shlomo, so my sister got married then, and my grandfather flew in to be Masada Kedushin, and together with him flew in my uncle, Reb Shmuel, Reb David's father. The Shabbos Sheva Brachas we spent in a hotel in Tveria. So Rav Alexander Lynchner, the founder of Boys Town by Tzvagan, he drove my grandfather to Tveria because he wanted to have a private conversation with him. Not that they were speaking about things that are private, but he just wanted to be with him for a few hours. So he offered to drive him to Tveria from Yerushalayim. And I got myself into the car also. It was Thursday, and we drove all the way to Tveria. My wife came the next morning. She's a teacher. She comes to miss class, whatever. And when she showed up in the hotel, so I introduced her. Here's my wife. And I had then a baby girl, a truly baby girl, a baby. And my grandfather asked me, what's her name? She wasn't even a year old. And I said, her name is Malka Chaya. So my grandfather clapped his hands. That was one of his things that, at a moment of joy or whatever, that, he clapped his hands and he said, I have an interesting story to tell you. My oldest daughter, and that's Rav Shurin's mother, Rebbetzin Malka Shurin, when she was born, so my mother-in-law came to me with a dream that I should call her Malka Chaya. But that's when I made my first protest against two names. My grandfather had this very interesting shita to give only one name. Historical grounds, he felt that in the Tanakh, in the Gemara, Tanoim, Rishonim, we don't really find two names amongst Jews. So therefore, he thought that maybe it was something that happened in Europe, something that Jews took from their Gentile neighbors. That's what he was afraid of, maybe. On other grounds, halakhically, because if a person was given two names, and then people only call him by one name, so it becomes maybe a Shiloh, what's his real name now, how to write a Ksuba or a Get, whatever. So this was his thing about not giving two names. So he said to me that my first protest, that's what he used that word, my first protest against two names was when my oldest daughter was born. But, he adds with a smile, but it seems that there had to be in the family a Malka Chaya. So I want to learn Pshat and this Maisa. My grandfather was a very rational person. There was nothing superstitious in his beliefs or anything close to him. As Rav Yonason was saying, he was a person whose mind, his intellect, governed every aspect of his life. And he did not say things, empty sentences. What does it mean? Oh, there had to be this name in the family. Why does it have to be? And what is, like, is there any significance to this name? It seems to be empty words. In his old age, after he suffered a stroke, so he spoke very little. At a time, the children thought that maybe he's lost his faculty of speech. They brought in doctors, whatever. And the doctor was asking him questions about this, how do you feel with this. So the doctor said to him, after a while, he said, I don't know why they say that you're not speaking. You seem to be speaking. So Rabbi Yaakov said, all my life I've been speaking Divrei Torah, but now I cannot concentrate in Gemara. My mind is too weak. What do you want me to speak about? The weather? It's in the book, right? So I want to say that shot in this last sentence was because my grandfather knew that I might feel bad that I gave two names, even though his whole shita was giving one name. Somebody else, fine, but I'm a grandson, I should respect his views. He insisted on this in the family to give only one name, and here I went and gave two names. So I might feel bad. Now that he found out that I gave two names, therefore he gave that extra sentence at the end of the whole story that, it seems that there had to be this Malka Chaya in the family. Even though it doesn't really mean anything, but it might make me feel good. And that's what was important to him. Even more than his whole shita about not giving two names, but that another person's feelings should not be slighted. The next morning, Friday, was breakfast, and that's when I discovered that he doesn't eat milk and cheese on Friday. I wasn't even aware of that. I hadn't read the book yet. So we were sitting at the table. My grandfather was at the head of the table. My father was on one side. My uncle Reb Shmuel was on the other side. And I was sitting next to my father. And in the course of the meal, I pierced down something. As I'm piercing it down, so my sleeve kind of like dipped into something that was on the table. My father sitting next to me saw it, and he tried to like stop it, like he put his hand underneath my hand to try to lift it in time. My father, I think, was a split second too late, and I soiled my shirt. My grandfather saw that, and he says, "Ah, I'm also a shlemazel. I also made plenty shirts dirty in my life." The moment that he said that, I recalled the famous story about Reb Kiveger. Reb Kiveger, the night of the Seder, he had over a poor person, a wandering beggar, invited over to the Seder, and being the Seder Kadesh, all the wine cups are poured out, and this poor person, he by mistake topples over his becher. And the wine is slowly spreading through the white satin tablecloth, making it a very nice red. Reb Kiveger sees that, so with his foot, he gives the table like a bang, and his own becher turns over. Reb Kiveger immediately says, "Oh, I see that the table is unsteady. It's a little wobbly. We have to be careful. That's why the cups are turning over." He tried to cover over the clumsiness of that beggar, that the beggar should not feel bad. Shabbos morning. Here you have another story with the Kriya Satara. We were in the hotel. The official time of davening in the hotel was, we'll say it didn't make the first man Kriya Shema. Okay. So we decided that we'll make our own early minyan. It was during the winter, so we decided Vasikin is not that early, we'll do Vasikin. They needed a balkore, so I offered to lane. In the course of the Kriya, so my grandfather corrected my laning. After Kriya Satora, so my grandfather calls me over, and he says to me, it was Pashas Vaera, "You said Neteis Yocha Bematecha. I corrected you to Bematecha. However, of course, grammatically, you're right. That's the way the pasuk should be." And then he went on with a whole long, lengthy discussion. It's in the Sefer Emes Liakov, a one-liner, but he explained it in great depth why over here it's different than it's Bematecha. But he started off saying that grammatically, you read it the right way. Again, correcting somebody, laning, that's like it's tantamount to miskavim b'kol chavero, mevayish b'chavo b'rabim. So again, he wanted me to feel that my mistake was not that much of a blunder. And then the last little episode that I remember. And all the different anecdotes that I'm saying over have this same common theme. How my grandfather is constantly sensitive to the people surrounding him and making sure that they feel at ease, no one is feeling hurt, everyone's feeling comfortable. So the last story. A young man who was he had a name of being a very brilliant person. I don't know exactly what his problems were, but he wanted very much to see my grandfather. To the extent that he traveled from Yerushalayim to Tveria to have a special audience with my grandfather. During that weekend, so I tried to hog my grandfather for myself as much as I can. I had to make the best of the opportunity. When this young person came, so I was politely asked to leave the room, like my uncle Reb Avraham would often be asked to leave the room. After that person left, so my grandfather starts telling me, I don't know what happened to the learning nowadays. He said to me in Yiddish, Hiltzen Akashas. The questions being asked are wooden. I think that means that when it's metal, so the metallic ring, it clings throughout the Beis Medrash, Akasha. However, nowadays it's like a thud. The questions are like banging on wood. They don't ring. And he starts telling me over what this person is to Makasha, and he said, I don't understand what the Kasha is, I don't know what even was bothering him. And then he went on to say what he thinks, his own analysis of why the Derech HaLimud, the method of learning, has changed so much. It's now, I would say, from the previous century to this century. And he said to me like this, when I started learning Gemara, so my first Gemara Rebbe, he wasn't such a big Talmud Chacham, and he learned the wrong pshat in the Gemara. He understood that the Gemara is having a doubt whether a calf gored another cow. At the time, it bothered him very much because he was born on a farm. And he witnessed baby calves being born, and they didn't seem to me to be very much strong enough, big enough, to be able to go around goring other animals. But he told me that I was very shy, embarrassed. I didn't want to ask the Rebbe this kasha. The Rebbe was a city folk, probably didn't even know the difference between a cow and a horse. So, but he knew, but he didn't ask the question. However, the question, it troubled him. Of course, to doubt, maybe the Rebbe has wrong shot in the Gemara, that would never enter his mind. Instead, he came up with a teretz. He said, this was my first shtickle Torah. So his teretz was that he remembered that as a little kid, his mother would read the Tzena Orena in Yiddish. It was a collection of Midrashim and Pirushim of the week's Parsha, so she would read that aloud to the little children every Shabbos afternoon. So he recalled that in the Tzena Arena it says that before the flood, a child was able to walk around even though he was still connected to the umbilical cord. So he thought to himself like this, that if children, newborn children, that are still tied with the umbilical cord can walk around, so maybe the calf in the Gemara is not like the calf back in Kalishkovka, that was the estate where he was born on. It's the calf from the Gemara. A calf from the Holy Gemara, maybe it can pick itself up immediately after birth and gore. That was his terrors. So he goes on and he says like this, when I was learning Gemara, it was the Halakha Gemara that asked the Kasha. The Holy Gemara is asking a question. The Halakha Gemara, the Holy Gemara is giving a teretz. I feel privileged that I'm allowed to peek into this holy sanctum of the Gemara and get a glimpse of what's going on. If I don't fully understand and appreciate, and I can't analyze the whole svara behind every kash and every teretz, it's due to my fault. But of course, the Gemara is holy. Rabbi Achber in the Shir, he would say, the Halakha Rashi, the Halakha Tosfos. That's how he would speak. Nowadays, said my grandfather, we have to understand everything. And if we don't understand, we can't go further. If we don't understand the word kash, we have to figure it out, no matter how much time it's going to take. Many times we feel that there is a kasha here, but we haven't fully defined it. We haven't given the exact wording to understand it. We don't go further. We can't budge. Of course, I'm speaking over here to university students coming from a whole different background. And all I can say is that the way you're learning Gemara here in Chappelle's and in Midrash Rachel, that's the right way for you. But over 100 years ago, in a little shtetl, it was a different world. And we should know that even though we do want to understand, but it still is the Halakha Gemara, really. The Gemara is still the Halakha Gemara. In any event, that was, my grandfather already started going over to other topics, and we forgot completely about that young man who had gotten this private audience with my grandfather. But afterwards, I was thinking to myself, did that young man come all the way from Yerushalayim to ask my grandfather a kasha and a gemara? That was what's bothering him? And for that he needed a private audience? Obviously not. He came with some kind of a personal problem. However, when he left, my grandfather immediately shifted the focus of his previous conversation that I might have felt that I was missing. What did I lose by not being in the room at the time? So my grandfather immediately pushed the conversation into that direction that, oh, he was asking me of Shad and the Gemara, and I don't know what he was asking, and whatever. He smoothed it out, making it seem as if, listen, Yosef, you didn't miss anything by not being here in the room. I think that that's what his real goal was, to make me feel good, knowing that I really, really ever even have a chance to see him, that he was in America and I was in Eretz Yisrael. Those are the few stories that I wanted to say over. It wasn't easy for me to come up with something because I think everything is in the book. But these few personal incidents are not in the book. And all I can say is that you should definitely read the whole book because it's a real Musa Sefer.
Certainly not that much to the book and Rav Yosef's own private things. But you're probably all wondering, as grandchildren, how did he relate to us? Did he relate to us like a grandfather? Or like we, perhaps the same way we related to him as a couple, maybe that's how he related to us. I want to say that it wasn't so. He certainly related to us just like a grandfather relates to a grandchild. I was going through old correspondence of my grandfather with my father when he was still a bachur in yeshiva, and it was shortly after my aunt, Reb Tenshurin, got married, and then they had their first child, Moshe, and every letter that he wrote to my father, I really cannot tell you how much it interested my father, but he would write, Moshe is doing this, and Moshe is doing that, he's walking, he was sick, they took him to the doctor, he's on antibiotics. The menial things that a grandfather is interested, certainly on the first grandchild, but I can say that I think for each and every one of us, he had the same feeling. Just to reiterate something that Rabbi Yosef mentioned, not to make us feel bad, I just, as I was sitting there, I recalled another story similar to that one of Rabbi Yosef. I once had the schus of spending Pesach with him, myself. They wanted somebody to be there to help. It was my grandfather, my grandmother, and myself. And actually, I was yeshiva bachur. Yeshiva bachur doesn't know how to wash dishes. I learned already, don't worry. But many things that yeshiva bachur doesn't know how to do, and one of those things was washing dishes. So the first thing I did was volunteer to wash dishes. And I washed the dishes, and instead of putting the glass down, I left it up to dry. So, of course, my grandmother comes in, admonishes me, what do you think you're doing? That's not the way to wash dishes. Chol HaMoed, we had a custom that the entire family would get together on a certain day on Chol HaMoed. We'd all meet together, my grandfather would talk, we would schmooze. A family get together. So, my father asks my grandmother, Nu, how was it? How was David? Did he behave? She goes, he's a batlin. He doesn't know how to wash dishes. So my grandfather turns to my father and he says, ahata zeyda echa batlin. His grandfather is also a batlin. Don't worry, he has to look after. The kids, that was his way of making me feel good. Don't worry about it. Yeah, your grandfather is also Batlin, and he got places in life. You'll also make it. On the other hand, he took an interest in each one of us to see where we're holding, what we're doing. I recall one time after Pesach, I had met him shortly after Pesach, and I had a spear beard. Now, his minig and our minig was the other shita that you can shave until Rosh Chodesh. And he looked at me and he says, "What's that on your face?" And I said, I figured if I'm not going to shave afterwards, I'll leave it already. He says, "What kind of business is that? What do you mean you're not going to shave? To walk around the streets like that when you don't have to?" So I learned from that you could give the mussar to your grandchildren also the way you have to. It didn't faze him. Just a few small impressions, stories that he left on us, on me. I once was asked to bring him from one wedding to another wedding. I had a friend, Rabbi Moshe Sherer's son, who was getting married that evening, and he had asked me to bring my grandfather from a wedding that my grandfather was being Masada Kedushin to his wedding, which was in Manhattan, in Flatbush to Manhattan. So I had arranged the car service, my grandfather, my grandmother, myself, and then there was a certain Rosh Hashiva who wanted to get a lift. He says, "You're going to that wedding, I want to come along." So we sat in the back, myself, my grandfather, my grandmother, and the Rosh Hashiva sat in the front. Now, anybody who's familiar with the New York car services knows that the music that they listen to is not exactly the music that we are all, or us religious Jews, try to listen to. The Rosh Hashiva turns to the driver and he says, "Can you please turn that off?" And he thought he was doing the biggest favor to my grandfather. And after the driver turns it off, he turns around to my grandfather and he says, in Yiddish he says, "Hakten kop." It's banging on my head. The rock and roll that was going on in the front was banging on my head. And he thought he was doing my grandfather the biggest favor by telling him to shut the music. So my grandfather looks at him and he says, "Sada Gemara." That was the first thing. If you want to understand what true Das Torah is, the first thing that comes to mind is, there's a Gemara, there's a Chazal. They speak about this too. And he says, the Gemara says that after the Churban Beis Hamikdash, actually says it before, when the Sanhedrin became Batel, I think, that it was ready, it's also to listen to music. And the Gemara goes on and says that for certain individuals, it was still permitted. You have those that go to see, it says, I think, that they're still permitted. So he said like this, he says, the pshat in the Gemara is like this. Certain people, for their jobs, they have to listen to music. They go on long roads, long ways, and in order to calm them down, the only thing that keeps them calm is the music banging on their heads. He says, take this taxi driver. He drives through the streets of Manhattan every single day, day in and day out. The only thing that probably keeps him sane in those streets is the music. So therefore, there was no reason to tell him to shut it off. That's probably what he needs for his job. So I learned from that not everything that we see or that we think is wrong is always wrong. But the first thing that came to mind was Chazal. What do Chazal say about this? What does the Torah tell us about this? One thing that not many of you, probably none of you, are familiar with, and maybe even Rabbi Yonason doesn't mention it much in the book, that's the last 2 years of his life. Rabbi Yosef did touch on one point, which I wanted to mention, but he said it already, so he saved me the job. But that's for sure that he suffered a stroke 2 years before he was Nifter. And basically he wasn't taken out that much. Not too many people came to see him at that point. The only ones that were still near with him were his grandchildren. His children and his grandchildren. I come to America shortly after he had his stroke. I come from Eretz Yisrael. I was there for Yom Tov, for Pesach. And they'd asked me to... They were taking turns of people staying with him, staying overnight in the hospital with him. So they'd asked me to stay overnight in the hospital. So I went to the hospital. Naturally, he greeted me with a smile. He wasn't able to talk. In fact, one of his wife's grandchildren came in then, and he was trying to make conversation. It was very, very difficult. It was shortly after the stroke. I didn't go to sleep that night. I sat there and I watched. In the middle of the night, he had to excuse himself. I helped him off the bed. Afterwards, I watched him, how he washed his hands. Lo yu'uman ki yisuper. I could not believe it. A man suffering a stroke, he was so, the halacha was so ingrained in him, he took the keli and he washed it, each hand, so carefully, that I saw that when a person comes to that madrega, that halacha, the Torah is so ingrained in him, everything he does, no matter what condition it is, he does it exactly the way it's supposed to be done. As Rav Yosef mentioned, that he said that, I have nothing to say. If I have nothing to say, I'm not going to say it. The pshat is that the Midah Sa'emes was so ingrained in him that if he has nothing important to say, you don't say it. I recall one final story. I think it's getting late. I was there with him, and a relative of mine came in and asked him to sign a paper. Now what happened was that there was an avreich who unfortunately was getting divorced, and his wife's family was spreading all kinds of false rumors about him. My grandfather knew this fellow's father, who's close with his grandfather. And this relative came in with a paper saying that there's nothing wrong with this avreich. He's normal. He's 100% normal. And he wanted my grandfather to sign it. And my grandfather wasn't speaking that much. And he looked at him and he says, "What's this?" And he starts explaining, you know, his father, you know, his grandfather. I just want you to sign that this younger man is 100% normal. Again and again, he looks at him. He wasn't talking. He just looked at him with his hands up in the air. And he says, as if to say, "I don't know. How can I sign this?" And after a while, the relative finally gave up and walked away. He saw that there's nothing doing. That means that the Midas Emes, knowing his father, and he nodded. He said, "You know his father?" He nodded. "You're his grandfather?" He nodded. But when it came to signing the piece of paper, "I don't know. How can I sign this paper?" The Midas Emes was so ingrained that even under the hardest conditions, he was able to refrain from bringing out or saying or even signing a piece of paper that would not be Emes. I think, I don't have to add much, but I think you've heard enough to realize that we're living in a time, the end of time, that Midas HaEmes is something which we certainly should strive to grow, to gain, and with that we'll be zeicher to Mashiach, Amen, Amen, Amen.